Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Oh, hey, before we start the show, I got to tell you about the Allegedly podcast with my lawyers, Bo Bowen and Ryan Schmidt. They got pop culture, they got legal news, they got behind the scenes antics and a whole lot of laughs. One of the best podcasts I've ever heard. Allegedly with Bo and Ryan at thebowenlawgroup.com. Link in the description and everywhere you get your podcasts, of course. And now let the cartoons begin.
The Bob Seska Show.
Bob Seska.
I think it's the best show on the air ever that has been. It's weird how good it is. It's so strange.
The Bob Seska Show.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, May 31, 2023, and this is the Bob Seska Interview on the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. Hi, I'm Bob.
Hello, Bob.
Hi. Day 861 of the Biden-Harris administration, 524 days until the 24th presidential election. You can find me on Instagram at TheBobSeska. My Twitter handle is BobSeska_go. Spoutable is BobSeska, and our Patreon page is BobSeskaShow.com. You got it? All right, so David Pepper returns to the show today to talk about state-level politics and his brand-new book called Saving Democracy, a user's manual for every American. I have a link in the description under this episode at BobSeska.com. Since the last time David was on, he started posting videos on his Twitter feed. Whiteboard videos is what they're called, detailing winning strategies for Democrats pushing back against autocracy by winning more state-level elections. So today we're going to dig into all of that, plus overcoming gerrymandering, how to make state politics sexy on social media, the future of the Republican Party, and so much more. So stick around. Meantime, think about supporting this fully independent podcast by subscribing to our Patreon page at patreon.com/BobSeskaShow. Okay, here comes me and David Pepper.
More fun, more music, the Bob Seska Show.
So since the last time you were on the show, God, it's been a while, you started doing these whiteboard videos. I wanted to talk to you about that first, the whiteboard videos, because they're gigantic. I mean, you're getting so much engagement and reach out of those things. I'm so grateful that you've endeavored to start putting yourself on video and to start explaining some of these things that desperately you need explained, especially when it comes to state-level politics.
It was honestly just a decision I made one day after the first book to explain the history of the suppression that led to Jim Crow.
Yeah.
That is so similar to the rhetoric and tactics of recent voter suppression. And I'm always horrified by the fact that after Reconstruction, you literally had black majorities in state houses in many states in the South. And then you saw a cratering of those majorities within years because of fierce white backlash. So that whiteboard walked through that. And I decided one day to do a whiteboard. I just did it in this little office I have. You can tell my whiteboards are pretty casual. And the thing exploded as I walked through those numbers. And it became very clear right away that there's something about the process of putting it in very simple terms in a short time frame that this, with something that's sort of sticks out. And I think what stuck out on that one was that people had no idea that, you know, more than half of the registered voters in Louisiana in, let's say, the 1870s were Black or other states. And so if I, you know, rather than just tweeting that, that little whiteboard really took off. So ever since, I've tried to capture these very basic concepts in whiteboards, and it's amazing how they do. It's been really kind of a surprise, and I guess almost dumb luck that I started doing them.
Are you finding that more of your viewers are now becoming engaged in state level politics as a consequence of this? Because I think that is one of the great benefits of what you're doing, shining the spotlight on state level politics, where, as far as I'm concerned, that's where all of the worst crap is being passed.
Yeah, no, it really has helped, because I just think that the default is so much about federal.
Yeah.
That just saying it, I mean, I think there are people who say it and people kind of roll their eyes like, we know, state houses matter. And it's sort of like a, of course, but we're not really going to focus on it.
Uh-huh.
So I think maybe my whiteboards have a way of making the case that, no, this is the front line.
Yeah.
This is not some side thing to build up some junior varsity group of politicians. This is a front line. This is the front line for the Koch brothers. And I will confess, my whiteboards can be somewhat repetitive, but it's because I want that to become so clear. So my hope is, amid a number of people and groups that are trying to make this case, that that people do see that. And if it takes like my kind of, you know, little 2-minute things to help make the case, I hope it makes people, I mean, one of my goals is I want to present something on a whiteboard that is, that honestly, once you see it, you can't really unsee it.
Yeah.
It's just so frame of how you thought about something.
Mm-hmm.
And we have such a federal frame and such a swing state frame that I want people to see 2 minutes and think, oh my gosh, I never thought about that way. And my very, it doesn't sound humble, but my goal is, I want them to see it and then never think about it the same way again. And so there's one, if you look at my Twitter feed, the one that I hope most has that effect is several whiteboards in a row where I walk through the two battles of politics and how one side sees it as this sort of battle over swing states for federal offices, and the other side sees it as an attack, a battle over democracy itself. And my goal is literally that when people see it, they will forevermore see it that latter way and understand it. Because once you see it, then you know how to do better within that frame than we're doing right now when it comes to democracy. So yeah, that's really the goal, is to have it be aha moment after aha moment, so people kind of can be better prepared for what we actually have to do.
Yeah, a couple of seconds ago, you said something about being repetitive, but I feel as though the other side is far more repetitive than we could ever be. And that works to their benefit significantly, because for some reason, the Republican side is able to push beyond just whatever news cycle is floating everyone's boat on a particular day, and to focus on the same beats over and over again, stirring up, obviously, activism, stirring up the donor base, and making strides along those lines. I think the repetitiveness actually works for Republicans, and I think maybe we need a little bit more of that here to kind of set aside everyone's talking about this, so we got to all talk about this, rather than saying, okay, well, here are the priorities and these are the things that we want to hammer home every day.
Yeah, actually, and you know, I hate to say it, it's sort of easy to be repetitive, because the consequences of their state level attack on democracy happen every single day.
Yeah.
So one reason I can be repetitive is I can say, oh, you're upset about Florida or Tennessee or Dobbs or, you know, the Ohio attack on the Constitution we're seeing, guess what? They're all happening for the same reason. And so the consequences of their front, you know, of the fact that they attack democracy through states plays out every single day somewhere and normally everywhere. And you get a little bit here and there in the news. Some of the cable shows focus more on it. But the truth is, once you see it as this state level attack, that's the heart of it, it becomes so clear that it's all the same strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And my hope is that people at all levels, all around the country, start to see it that way. And the reason it feels repetitive is because it's one uniform strategy coordinated across all these states. And so there are different consequences everywhere. You know, one state, all of a sudden, there's a 6-week ban, no exceptions. the other state they're censoring your books. The other state, you know, they're trying to change the Ohio Constitution. It's all the same attack. And I think that that leads to obviously a whole lot of repetition because it's all the same root cause.
For the Republican side, they seem to be pretty good at making state level politics sexy and making that resonate, especially on social media. And your efforts aside, why is it so difficult for Democrats to view state level politics as being sexy, as being one of those things that could drive engagement, drive reach on social media and get attention of a lot of people? What is the disparity here, David, between how the Republicans are framing their state level politics agenda while the Democrats, and I'm talking about Democrats in terms of activists and those of us who participate in our own way on social media and so on. What's the difference between these two sides as far as getting that particular milieu to resonate on social media?
Oh my gosh, there's so much to say on that one. I mean, one, by the way, some are good.
Yeah.
Where have Democrats, and let's say pro-democracy Americans, gotten their biggest wins? Through federal legislation.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to have a default of thinking if we want to get things done, we've got to go federal. And that has been our history. And the truth is that can be the source of the most powerful, robust progress. And frankly, next time we have majorities, we better do something about that reality.
Yeah.
So I think our default is our biggest victories have been federal. We seem to be more about kind of charismatic star candidates.
Yeah.
They get us really pumped up. You know, mm-hmm. Barack Obama, who's the next Obama? Normally that's a federal conversation and it's a presidential or U.S. Senate conversation. So I worry that we have sort of a habit of looking for those celebrity bigger than life candidates that we really can feel good about. It. Maybe sometimes someone breaks through like a Mallory McMorrow and inspires us at the state level. But normally that's going to lead to a real focus on the most high profile positions. The Republicans don't care if these state reps are the most boring, unimpressive, you know, inarticulate people imaginable.
Yeah.
Because they're focused more on power than people. And so they understand that, well, that person may be scandalous. They may resign in scandal. They may be unimpressive. We don't care as long as they do what we want them to do, which is suppress democracy and push through a far right wing agenda. That's some of it. Another one is that they understand that quite a big difference. They are the right wing. They know they have a minority viewpoint. They know that they only win if they suppress democracy enough to put a minority viewpoint in place. That's automatically going to push them towards the states because that's where you can get that done. The side on the more left, I worry, is changing some, but that side is still quite confident, oh, the democracy's intact. Now, this is changing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the reason we got ourselves, I think, into a corner over years is for a while we thought, well, it's post the Voting Rights Act, we're fine. We don't need to worry about the state of democracy. It's stable. So we'll just go win federal offices to get good things done. And if we don't win in the states, that doesn't really matter because, you know, not as much will get done there. They have, because they have to suppress democracy, they have just been more focused on the offices that do that. And again, those are state houses. And the last two I'll say, like I said, it's a long answer. We're now in a jam. We are now feeling panicked that the next federal election, if we lose, we'll never have democracy again. And by the way, that's a legitimate risk.
Oh, yeah.
Every cycle, we have almost a panic. We got to win. And so now we're never giving ourselves any time or being disciplined enough to say, of course, we got to win the next federal election. But amid that priority, we also have to start shoring up our work at the state house level. So every 2 years, we think, well, maybe we'll get to that in the future, but now we can't afford it. And so we just kind of keep playing the same game where we never have a long-term plan. We only have the short-term must-win strategy. And the final one, I told you it'd be a lot, is we have now gotten to the point where I just think people have given up on most states that are not pretty purple or blue.
Mm-hmm.
And that also is a self-fulfilling prophecy. And you and I will both remember when Iowa went with Obama and Indiana went with Obama and Missouri went with Clinton. When you don't compete in places, you make them harder to attain.
Yeah.
In the end, maybe feel near impossible to attain, but not competing in those places ends up being a disaster. But I think there's also a mindset now, it's a waste of money, it's not worth it. And if you believe that democracy itself is at stake, that attitude becomes a disaster, because the reason extremism is taking hold and undergoing a downward spiral in all these states is one side has basically left these states to even make arguments. And that only rewards the extremists. And the only battle in those states is about how extreme you get, which the extreme side wins. So those are all reasons that I think that one side is kind of just checked out of all these places where democracy is shaped, while the other side's going for broke in those very places.
Yeah, and I don't know if you've thought about this, David, at all, but in terms of strategizing for kind of a framework to provide a little bit more lead time when there's some sort of awful piece of legislation X going through state legislature Y, and it has something to do with a topic, let's say bans on gender-affirming care, which are really hot items right now in Republican state legislatures. How do we present to the grassroots more lead time as far as generating activism and pushback against those particular laws so that we're not only finding out about these things after they've passed, after it's too late? Seems like Democrats often jump aboard something after it's too late and we rend our garments and go, why, oh, why did this thing pass? Well, I know the answer to that. It's because we weren't paying attention to it before it passed. And I don't know if that makes any difference that we pay attention to something like that before it passes. We're talking about gerrymandered state legislatures and so on. It seems fait accompli in some cases. But it seems like knowing about these things is the first step toward successfully pushing back against them. So how do we do that? How do we set up that process to get the word out about some of these awful, draconian Republican laws?
Well, that's also a question with a lot to say. One, once you see that it's a long game, and a huge theme in my book is that we're in a long game, that's when you start to see that if you don't start and you just keep repeating the same mistakes, it gets worse and worse. So every single time these things come up, we need to be in these places engaging. And I have a whole chapter in this book called about state house advocacy. And how, of course, it matters. Even if it passes, if you have a big crowd that makes a lot of noise and makes it feel controversial over time, you're shaping the debate so much better than if no one shows up and it's viewed as both normal or largely even unknown that thing passed. So the advocacy at the time is really important. And what I would say to anyone in a state, if you are doing any kind of political organizing, this is a very practical suggestion I make in the book. Make sure that whatever group you're in, whether it's generally thinking about Senate or U.S. or local, have some part of your footprint be about state house advocacy. Have someone in your group whose job it is to keep up with those bills, to get, you know, a lot of state houses, you could sign up to get the committee reports or whatever. But at every meeting you have someone report out to the group. Here's what's happening to state house. We have to start building some infrastructure in states amid many groups that often do not look at the state house. Add that to the list of things you're paying attention to, because whatever your issue is, I promise you, there's some aspect of it being either helped or badly hurt at the state house.
Yeah.
The other thing I'd say, the frame, the way we respond to these outrages, as you're saying, is normally too late. We haven't made the noise we've made. And now that's not always true, but sometimes.
Yeah.
But the number two one, and this is one, and I don't mean to criticize, because I respect these folks, but, you know, after Dobbs, what was the big Democratic national push? Let's go elect more U.S. senators. And that literally, it's like we're changing the subject. What we should be saying, in addition to trying to win the Fetterman and the Warnock races, of course we got to win those, is, pardon my French, who the hell passed that law in Mississippi? Who voted for it? Who's running against them? And let's give them hell for the next year.
Yeah.
Why? And you know that the authors of the abortion bans in Texas, in Ohio, the one that sent that 10-year-old raping to Indiana, and Mississippi, not one of those three even had an opponent the next November?
Oh, God.
Of course they're going to keep doing this. So our response can't just be, you know, I use a soccer analogy. Hey, we needed a better goalie. if the other team has 10 people on offense shooting shot after shot after shot, the goalie isn't going to save the day. You need to have people on the field in front of the shots, blocking the shots. And that means you need to be in that state, running against these people, recognizing that many of the things they're passing are toxic, even in that state. But if no one's there running, no one even knows about it, or no one even pays attention to it. So the other way to do it is to answer, is when do you do it? That's right now. Recruit right now. Every state house district in Virginia, I guess they call it the assembly, or I can't remember what they call it, but recruit. There should be a candidate in every district.
Yeah.
Next year, every one of these. So start recruiting. If you're in a district right now that hasn't had a challenger in a couple years, and you've got some extremist passing all these crazy laws, make it your mission that by the recruiting deadline, either you're running or you found a great, impressive friend to run. But that's the other way to do it. Because here's what happens if you don't do this. Every incentive those extremists face, if no one runs against them, is to be more extreme to avoid a primary. They feel no incentive to be more moderate. The Tennessee Republicans, every incentive in their world was to kick off the two Justins out of that legislature. They had no incentive to keep them in their world of unaccountability. So we have to change that lack of accountability by giving them hell as the laws are being pushed through the state houses, but also whoever is doing these outrageous things, have someone knocking on doors throughout their district for months, even Republican doors, saying, oh, you didn't know your state rep that lives down the street and looks so nice in those parades is a total extremist that sent a 10-year-old rape victim to Indiana? Well, that's your state rep. Let's make a change. There's a lot of toxic and unpopular people things these people are doing, but no one knows it because no one runs against them.
Yeah, and I think if we can find some way to emphasize who the rock stars are, because if we couple rock stars with dramatic issues, people like the two Justins, as you just mentioned, Josh Shapiro in Pennsylvania, Wes Moore in Maryland, Mallory McMorrow, who you mentioned a second ago, these are all dynamic characters. And all we got to do is continue to reemphasize their presence on social media. And I think a lot of Democrats will go along with that. I think a lot of liberal activists in the grassroots will pick up on that and begin to activate in that direction. So what you're doing with your whiteboards and certainly with your new book, Saving Democracy, is so crucial, I think, to that effort.
Yeah, I really that's the one thing I also think, if people do pay attention, they are going to see that there are a lot of real stars at the state house level.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the Tennessee Three really inspired people. Malachi Marr inspired people. I have a monthly meeting of a group I've started called Blue Ohio. And every month I invite a couple of the state reps who are in our Democratic caucus, our artificially small one, thanks to illegal gerrymandering. I'm telling you, every meeting, these guests knock the socks off the members of this group.
Mm-hmm.
They're an impressive group. And if we gave them more of a microphone, like the Tennessee Three and the Malachi Marr basically grabbed when they were so frustrated, if we actually highlighted them more, if the national media took a few of the people that follow Kevin McCarthy through the halls of Congress and sent them to cover state houses, you know, how many of those people do we need covering whatever McCarthy is saying? It looks like there are 100 following in tow. Send them out to these states. You will find a lot more really impressive people that, if we listen to them, would inspire us to see what's being done in these places and what can be done to stop some of the worst of what's being done. So I agree. Understand where power is.
Mm-hmm.
And then highlight some of these really able public servants who are literally on the front line of this battle.
Yeah.
They're not the bench for the future. Mallory Morrow said this when she announced she wasn't running for the U.S. Senate. We need to stop framing. This goes back to one of your earlier questions. We got to stop framing these offices as some bench for some other job that's ultimately more important.
Yeah.
The Koch brothers don't think of – they created ALEC.
Mm-hmm.
The Legislative Exchange Council, not as a bench building exercise for future members of Congress. They create it because they understand that the state houses are the front line, doing most of the damage and accomplishing most of the right wing agendas. So, as you say, these are the front lines. There are a lot of stars. let's highlight them and let's amplify their voice as much as we can.
Yeah, it's like what happens on the Hill, what happens in Washington, D.C. is like the main event. That's like the main stage, while political consultants were all operating in this smoke-filled room at the state level. They were able to accomplish this long game that has occurred over the last 50 years, taking over these state houses and really solidifying a base at that level while we're all looking at the shiny object, looking in the other direction. It's this amazing magic trick of misdirection that we've kind of fallen prey to. And I hope all of this turns that around. But, you know, I wanted to mention here your video today, your whiteboard video, is about the Ohio Republicans gutting the state constitution. Can you talk about that for a second without spoiling too much from your video?
Basically, you know, this is a this attempt they're doing to have a special August election to raise the threshold of amending the Constitution to 60%. And they're doing it very obviously because there's an effort right now to gather petitions to have a referendum in November, like Kansas had last year, to enshrine a right to choose in the Ohio Constitution.
Yeah.
And they realize that the majority of Ohioans are pro-choice. Every poll shows that. So they're trying to rig the rules or move the field goal posts or cheat, whatever word you want to use, to change it so that what would have been a successful effort anytime it was done in the last 100 years is suddenly a failing effort because they moved the number to 60%. But the point of my video today is not only is it obvious that they're scared of that pro-choice majority like they are across this country, the entire effort is lawless. You know, it's a gerrymandered legislature that's only the product of an illegal, unconstitutional gerrymander that was found unconstitutional by the Ohio Supreme Court. Not only is this the most corrupt state house in the country, the FBI is literally the Speaker of the House recently is a recent Speaker of the House, I should say, is about to be sentenced to prison for many years, I imagine, for the biggest bribery scandal in the history of our state.
Wow.
But they literally, the August special election, the date that they are pushing to have this election on is right now in the Ohio Revised Code, an illegal date. Because only months ago, they themselves made it illegal because they said August was a bad day to have a special election. They tried to revoke that law, rescind that law when they passed this thing, but they didn't have the votes to rescind it. But that shows you they knew it was illegal. They tried to rescind the law making it illegal. They couldn't get there. So they're just demanding that it happen anyway. And obviously, and so we have a date, we have an election on a date for which it is illegal to have an election in a couple months. And this will all go to the House Supreme Court. And this is sort of the last layer of lawlessness. And of course, the swing justice on that court is the son of the sitting governor who said he supports this thing. And this son has a really bad habit of not recusing himself in the most important cases. So the rule of law basically is melting in front of our eyes in Ohio. And it's a perfect example of what happens once there's one violation of the rule of law, and then the next, it becomes normalized for them, and they keep doing it and doing it. And however they can grab power, they grab it, even if it means that they're literally scheduling an election on the day that it's illegal to. And my great worry is the court will go along with it, because now we basically have reached a point where our court won't stand for the rule of law either.
So did this process of doing these whiteboards inspire you to create a companion piece to Laboratories of Autocracy with this new book, Saving Democracy? Is that where that came from? What's sort of the origin story of this this new companion book that you've got out?
You know, the origin story was actually, and when you write, sometimes this is what happens. You get a lot of reader feedback. And I learned very quickly after one book, if you hear the same thing from more than one reader, it's a good time to listen to that reader, that feedback. Mm-hmm. And what I heard about the first book is, and you'll know this from having a prior conversation, and even my whiteboards, the subject matter I am talking about is actually really painful and disturbing.
Yeah.
And when you went, and the whole point of my first book, this book called Laboratories of Autocracy, was to almost shock people into how bad things are in states. And I accomplished that goal so much that people would say, oh, my God, David, it was so hard to read how bad it is. I had to keep skipping to the end to get to your solutions because I had to feel better before I could continue on with this terrible story of what's happening. And at the end of that book, you'll remember I had 30 steps of what we can all do about it. Well, I heard that enough. I thought, you know what? I'm just going to write an entirely separate book that's only about what people can do about it practically. What once you have come to your and my conclusion that the state of democracy is under fierce attack, and it's actually that attack is working, and that attack is in states, this second book is, as it's called, a user's manual. Everything you can do about it once you see that battle. And the good news in this sober conclusion that it's under attack in all these states is it's not as if you have to just sit around and watch DOJ investigations and Senate votes to do something. In fact, that's not doing anything. Once you realize that you are sitting on the front lines of the battle wherever you are, because it's everywhere, the truth that it opens up a world of possibilities of all the things you can do. I mentioned, make sure your uncontested district for all those years is no longer uncontested. Make sure that you're engaging the very voters that are being disenfranchised by these voter suppression efforts at state houses. Make sure that we're signing up to do as much election official recruiting as Steve Bannon is doing of election deniers. On and on and on. There are so many ways that people can help. And the feedback from the first book I got without people directly saying it is they wanted a lot more of that, and they wanted to be able to get right to it, which the book does.
All right. So if you're sick and tired of the usual fare on cable news and from other very serious political analysts like Andrea Mitchell or Chuck Todd, here's a great way to support independent media. I'm talking about this podcast. For just $5 per month, you can support our Patreon page as we guide you through the madness and chaos of our politics. But it's not just about supporting shows like this one. You're also going to get bonus content as a reward for your monthly support. So we're talking about exclusive access to our Shadow Docket show recorded after the end credits on our Tuesday and Thursday shows. You also get access to the Patreon app where you can download the free show and our bonus content. Plus, you can join the discussion with our community of Patreon members in the comments under each episode. All of that for just $5 per month, just pennies per episode. So don't miss out. Again, that's BobSeskaShow.com. Bookmark it, send it to all your friends, and we thank you.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Bob Seska!
I get the sense, David, that a lot of participants, a lot of activists, a lot of grassroots people kind of see gerrymandering and go, hey, you know, it's Chinatown, Jake. How do you get past that? How do we elect more Democratic state legislators when the Republican state legislatures are so protected, so shielded by gerrymandering at that level? What do we do as far as pushing beyond that excuse? Like, okay, I don't want to participate in state politics because it's so gerrymandered. What's the use? How do we get past that?
You know, that is absolutely the problem.
Yeah.
And of course, I mean, my whole first book is essentially the hell and the poison of gerrymandering. Mm-hmm. And it is really hard. But I've come to a conclusion in thinking about all this and talking and getting in different states that as bad as gerrymandering is, far worse is not running in all these districts.
Yeah.
Even if it's gerrymandering, that's their goal. Their goal is that we don't run because it's gerrymandered. And once we are sort of completing the act when they gerrymander, then we don't run. That's when we're giving them their perfect state to do all that they're doing. And I went through it. Once you're not running at all, these people cease to be public servants entirely. They have no connection back to the public, zero accountability, zero transparency. So the first point is, in a world of democracy being under attack and extremism thriving because of no accountability, running even a gerrymandered district brings tremendous value if you do it right, even if you do not win. And that's sort of the aha insight that I made and that others need to see, that if you are running in every one of those Virginia districts, all 90, I believe, we are much better off than if we're only running in 60, even if those extra 30, let's say they all lose, you're far better because those other 30 will feel for the first time in their lives some measure of accountability. And if these candidates are doing a good job, hopefully accountability right in their face because someone's knocking on 20,000 doors or 10,000 doors, explaining in their hometown how extremist they are. And that's the other thing. It's really important to understand that the laws these people are passing are often far more extreme than even their districts. That's why they gerrymander, so they can get away with that stuff. If everything was hunky-dory back home in terms of the popularity of what they were pushing, they would need to gerrymander, would they? So the accountability that comes from running everywhere is really important, but other benefits come as well. Running everywhere means you have a higher turnout. Data shows that. Mm-hmm. You're not leaving Stacey Abrams or Beto O'Rourke or Val Demings to literally be the field operation of 20 or 30 districts that are otherwise not competed for. You have people on the ground in all these districts knocking on doors, getting the vote out. They're sort of your auxiliary field operation, but they're in person. They're a local retired teacher, someone else who's hopefully known and respected, helping lift the statewide elections. The other thing is, you never know where you're going to win. These states, like look at Kansas voting for abortion decisively. Mm-hmm. These state houses are so extreme that the records these people are putting together are toxic, often where they live. But you never would know. You may not win most of these or even like a quarter of them. But breaking through in a few places is real progress. And the last one, and I think that will happen, but of course it doesn't happen if you don't run anywhere. You also have no idea when someone's going to go belly up in a corruption scandal, which is happening all the time in these states. Yep. You better be running against them in case that happens as almost an insurance policy. And the last one is, when did Ohio Democrats pick up 6 seats in our state house, not having picked up a single seat in a terribly gerrymandered state? In 2018. That was also, I was chair then, that was also the only year that we ran someone in all 99 districts. And when you run in all 99 districts, you force them to spend their money differently than simply ganging up on the 5 or 6 swing seats that everyone's focused on. Because those folks in these other districts who often never had an opponent are worried when they do. And rather than sending all their money in an uncontested race off to the caucus to then give it to the swing candidates, they have to protect themselves back home. So you're forcing them to think differently when you run everywhere than if you don't. So I also think long term, if you do it every time and you build up a base of support, you keep building it, you do start to change the incentive system in these broken state houses. Again, 50% of the Tennessee Republicans who voted out the two Justins did not have an opponent last November. Mm-hmm. They will never change. They will only get worse if that remains the case. I want to have all 50 of those people face opponents, even if almost all of them win, at least thinking, you know, the next time I'm running, I'm in a general election, and I got really tired of hearing about what I was doing negatively towards these common sense neighbors of mine that just aren't that political. That doesn't happen unless you're running everywhere. So those are some of the reasons, but it is a, we have come to accept not running in so many places as business as usual, because we only focus on federal swing races. And by doing that, we are literally accepting massive amounts of damage being done by extremists and against democracy, because that's the fuel that allows so much of it to happen. Those uncontested races.
Oh, yeah. And I got the sense, David, that Republicans are prone to picking up a position just because it's the opposite of what the Democrats do. So there's got to be a way to trick Republicans into opposing gerrymandering. I feel as though if the Democrats can come up with a strategy where you somehow manipulate Republicans into supporting gerrymandering. I know that's a really cynical take how to do it, but I think there's a possibility there.
I like the way you're thinking. I mean, right now, you know, we had an anti-gerrymandering thing at the Senate. They wouldn't do it. They'd love to call out there are some Democratic states that try and gerrymander, but oftentimes, like New York, got called out by a court. Unlike Ohio, they followed the court order. But they followed the court order. Here, they just broke the law. My worry is that they understand too well. They'll take a few Democratic gerrymanders as long as they can keep gerrymandering, because without it, their extreme agenda dies.
Yeah.
And by the way, who comes back? Moderate Republicans, which the extremists don't want. I mean, the moderate Republican, many of whom gerrymandered the country 10 years ago, John Kasich, John Boehner, they're the ones who did a lot of the gerrymandering back then. They are now almost extinct because of the gerrymandering. And I don't think that they know that gerrymandering is so necessary to protect their extremist agenda that I don't think, and you saw it this round, they will not stop. In our state, they violated the Constitution 7 times to keep it going, even when the voters voted 70% to end gerrymandering, and it was very clear the court ruled against them. It's so central to their strategy of undermining democracy. I don't think they will let it go unless they're absolutely forced to, and that includes daring the Supreme Court as it did in Ohio by violating the law 7 times. And here's the worst part. It worked. So they'll always do that if they can. So I think whenever you're close to ending gerrymandering, like Wisconsin now is because they won that court race, be prepared.
Yeah.
Because the thing they will fight for harder than anything they fight for is to keep their rigged system going, because they know that without it, they would lose. Their records are indefensible. They're too extreme. Their outcomes are often indefensibly bad when it comes to public outcomes around, you know, schools or infrastructure. They can't defend these things. Mm-hmm. So they realize, the smart ones, that if they're not gerrymandered, they're done for. And their extremist brand of politics is especially done for.
What do we do, David, as far as disabusing what I would call contrarian voters from supporting third-party candidates against an incumbent president, sort of like RFK Jr., Marianne Williamson, support for people like that, and then for maybe a third-party candidate in the general election, this no-labels party that's being financed partially by Harlan Crow? How do we dissuade people from supporting those kind of spoiler candidates?
I think this is the case. I actually go through this in this book. I have a whole chapter on messaging.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's got to be that we really explain what a threat these guys are, not just to democracy in a general sense, but to the lives that the attack on democracy impacts your life in certain very direct ways. And abortion became created the directness in 2022 that also helped defeat the election denying Secretary of State candidates all over the country. So I think it's not going to be just us saying, well, look, we got this done and that done. We have to say that, of course, but it's got to be. And the good thing is the truth is on our side here. We don't have to exaggerate a thing. That make it clear that Trump is a threat, and that in a way that we didn't do nearly as well, obviously, in 16 and other races, that voting anywhere else is a threat, that this guy who could directly upend your life with the things he wants to do that are, you know, authoritarian, undemocratic and the like, also means that, you know, your family could be thrown asunder because of, you know, abortion bans, no exceptions and the like. I think we have to be very aggressive on offense with a very tough message about what they would do.
Yeah.
But I do worry. I don't worry about the primary. I think that's less of a concern, but this, what are they called? No labels thing is really disturbing. And clearly, you know, by the way, I'm sitting here next to some of my books. I happen to be at my home office today. My kids are off from school. And my second book is called The Wingman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Wingman is literally a plot to recruit an extra person in a primary to screw up the favorite. That's literally the plot, and Dark Money is behind the plot. I wrote this book in like 2018, and I really hate to see that this silly plot I came up with in a book that hopefully is a good read is actually what's clearly going on here. This is not, I think, some good faith effort. I think there's, as you said, Harlan Crow, there's some big money out there who understand Trump will really struggle to win if he's the candidate against Biden. I just think that, you know, America voted him out. I think they'd vote him out again. He needs that third party, that third candidate in there, because he thinks, and I think they'd be right to think this is the risk, that almost all those votes would be coming out of Biden's corner and not out of his. So it's really, it is scary if it happens. You know, don't get any signatures, folks. They're going in these certain swing states. Don't help them. It will only get Trump elected. And then come election time, hopefully we can have the same message. But it will involve us being very tough about what a Trump presidency would mean.
I always question whenever I read something about no labels and the money that someone like Harlan Crow has infused into that nascent party. I always wonder why we're not doing something like that on the left. And, you know, when I talk to Cliff Schechter, for example, Cliff and I always lament that for some reason on the left, we just don't get the funds. We just don't have the money flowing in the way the Republican side does. And that, of course, would finance efforts like that, sort of Operation Chaos kind of efforts.
Right.
Why isn't that happening on the left? I mean, beyond money, is there some other factor other than money?
My sense is, by the way, that, and this is the problem with dark money outfits, there's a whole lot of legal risk this too. I mean, if you're coordinating any way, I mean, you're running afoul of law. So I think these things are also could be highly risky, and most careful people. I mean, you basically didn't, we had in Florida, some Republicans go to jail about this exact kind of floating of insertion of a third party candidate in certain races. And it was found to have been coordinated with the party. And I think people broke the law by doing so. So I think they're also, I'm not saying that, I can't say that about, I don't want to say that that no labels is doing that. But I think they're really fraught with risk too. And so the average person's going to not want to go near that if they can help it. And by the way, one thing I've decided in life, and this is true with the privatizing of public schools and this, whenever I see something that on the surface just makes zero sense, zero sense,
yeah.
There's money creeping around. I mean, when you hear them say, oh, well, this just means that we'll elect a great third party candidate and neither Trump or Biden will win. That's ridiculous. And so whenever I hear that, it's not some reasonable path, just like them giving away public school money to private vouchers. That hasn't worked to improve education, but they keep doing it. Why? Because someone's making money out of it. In this case, it's clearly to me big money driving the whole thing more than some grassroots effort to get some third party person elected. It's just not a credible suggested course that's going to happen from this.
What happens to the Republican Party after Trump goes away? I mean, I tend to lean in your direction on this. And I know my friend Hal Sparks is very optimistic when it comes to 2024 and Trump's fortunes, as far as that goes. That what happens to the Republican Party after Donald Trump steps away, after he's no longer a factor? Do they pick up that baton and keep running with it? Or do they kind of say, all right, well, maybe it's time to reevaluate and move in a different direction? It seems like the culture war horse is out of the gate. It seems like it's going to keep going. Where do you land on the future of all of that?
So my big picture on the Republican Party is quite bleak. I mean, I think that most of the anti-democratic activity that we have been watching, if Donald Trump were locked up tomorrow for any of the investigations he's in, it would all continue. They wouldn't stop banning drop boxes or stop gerrymandering or stop doing what they're doing in Ohio, because this started before Donald Trump as well. This began in, you know, 2000. The most recent iteration was Obama wins. Karl Rove figures out how to win all those state houses in 2010. And they've been going at it ever since, gerrymandering, suppressing the vote. And it's accelerated because the less accountability they have, the more the incentives incentivize being an extremist, incentivize attacking democracy. And then people are really profiting also out of what these state houses are giving them. So the forces that are leading them in that downward spiral are don't begin or end with Trump. And I worry that they will continue. Now, as a national matter, I think, you know, they start, well, it depends on what they do. I mean, if they can get a slightly more moderate version of Trump and use it to build off, or a slightly more sort of moderately appearing version, and then take advantage of all their anti-democratic work so that certain voters are suppressed and they're having majorities because of gerrymandering and all that, they could still do well, sadly. And I think this is why I think there's an opportunity in the short term to do really well for democracy. But I think the answer is actually more dependent on what we do. Do mm-hmm. we use the 24 election with all the extremism that's so clear from Marjorie Taylor Greene to DeSantis to Trump? Do we use it to simply win a presidential race and hopefully gain the House back and keep the Senate? Or do we run in every district? Do we start recruiting now? Do we start empowering voters to actually continue to make progress we started in 22 in some of those state houses? So we're really starting to strengthen the core of democracy in these states. Because if we want to have a good future, that's how we will get it done.
Yeah.
And hoping for some Republican collapse because Trump's so crazy, maybe that happens. But they have such a head start in so many places because of how much they've attacked democracy in these states, that unless we get into those states and undo the damage and start passing pro-democracy laws like in Michigan, even Connecticut passed one the other day, Minnesota, win these states and then lift democracy, that's how long-term we really start to get ourselves in a position to do well and have and force the Republicans to go from being a party that essentially is relying on attacking democracy to being a party that actually has to confront the reality, which is most of their views are in the minority. And unless they somehow modernize their views, they will continue being the minority. You are not going to exist in the 21st century as a party unless you're cheating really intensely, saying people, abortion should be banned, no exceptions. That's already unpopular, but wait until the teenagers and 20-somethings get older. It's going to be even worse for them. So I think we have to force a fair democracy playing field, and then that will force, I think, Republicans to confront that right now they are really got themselves into a deep corner of extremism on both economics and social stuff. And if they ever hope to win in a real democracy, they've got to update their views.
I want to get your take on
that. Only happens if we force them to see that,
yeah,
because they can no longer win by gerrymandering, changing constitutions, disinformation and the like, all of which are designed to keep there from being actual elections on their agenda, which they know would be losing elections.
Okay, one last short break. Back with more David Pepper right after these words.
Bob Seska plays more music.
Before we wrap up, David, I want to get your take on the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. Was just passed in Minnesota. In fact, you mentioned Minnesota a second ago. That brings the total electoral votes of the states that have approved this national popular vote thing up to about 205 electoral votes. And that leaves states like Virginia, I think Colorado, Nevada, Pennsylvania is another big one. If the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact can be passed in those states, that would bring the total electoral votes up to 270 votes. I feel as though this may be, well, it's actually a double-edged sword. This may be an issue that can get a lot of Democrats to turn out for state-level elections. In addition, I wonder how much of a big deal we should be making of it. I don't want to flag too many Republicans. I don't want to alert them as to what's going on, right, because we're tantalizingly close. I mean, right, just 65 electoral votes away from all of these states handing over their electors to the winner of the national popular vote, which invariably has been the Democratic presidential candidate. Is that something that you think could motivate voters, activists, and so on to focus on these state level elections?
I mean, I think it could. I mean, sometimes I worry that sort of higher level democracy issues appeal to some.
Yeah.
But to a lot of the voters that, you know, so many of these swing states are relying on, do you motivate your base to turn out? Mm-hmm. And if it's an irregular voter, normally it takes something that's more directly impactful on their life, you know?
Yeah.
That, you know, name the abortion last year played that role, frankly, in a lot of states. So I think, I always think that connecting these sort of higher level reforms and democracy principles and making sure people see how their own lives are affected really matters. So that may be what you, what gets it done, or maybe, maybe it's the fact that wages would go up if they showed up and voted for a minimum wage ballot.
Yeah, that's
true. That would be better. Yeah. And so, and you know that the impact may be electoral college or ending gerrymander or something else, but the thing that makes someone, you know, we have a large, and I go through this in the book, I have several chapters on it. There's a huge group of people that are totally disengaged from politics. They have made a decision, and then it's been furthered by nonstop suppression, that voting doesn't change their life. So why bother? And why bother if you, let's say you served in jail for a few years and you don't really know the voting laws and you see Ron DeSantis locking up people for voting wrong. Do you really want to risk your own freedom by voting when you're not sure what the rules are and not thinking it will make a difference to you anyway? So we have a whole set. It's a huge number of people who just aren't voting. And to get them voting again, we've got to think harder about who talks to them and what they say. As Stacey Abrams says, this is a persuasion message. It's not a get out the vote message. Frantically knocking on a door with a week to go and saying, do you remember to vote? You know, so-and-so's up for president. If someone has decided that voting doesn't matter in their life, that's not going to change their mind on that.
Yeah.
It might actually reinforce that they're simply like a, you know, this is a transactional thing to help someone else because he never showed up before the final week to even talk to them. So I think that to get to sort of the deeper level of disengagement that a lot of communities are going through, I actually think, you know, there's some real work that has to be done. And I go through how in the book. And by the way, one of the things that Trump has done that is the reason why I think in the short term they can't quit Trump is he has a secret sauce to getting out rural disengaged voters that had not been showing up. And by popping that rural turnout up to levels that have been far higher, he has actually, no other Republican does that. Mike DeWine in Ohio, Kemp, you know, Mitch McConnell, they don't get those people out. Mm-hmm. And so he does. And so I think a lot of these swing state battles are coming down to who has the means and the strategies and the messages that turn out the more disengaged voters that in the end, if they show up in numbers, actually change the outcome. And that's where I'd say I'm not sure the Electoral College argument does that. That could be a consequence of it. I think it's much more direct, something about your life, you know, that will be dramatically improved, or that someone, sadly, on the other side, or that the other side has really scared you about. You know, the caravan coming in 18.
Yeah.
That caravan from the South, that was all about getting their turnout. And it worked in many places. It didn't work in suburbia, but it wasn't meant to. It worked in rural places like Ohio, red parts of Ohio, Missouri, Indiana, and basically saved candidates who were not doing very well because the turnout spiked. So I think we've got to dig in deep and figure out there's certain messages that really pop that turnout and connect any big issue we care about, connect it to those types of issues.
Well, and plus, even if the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact becomes a thing and there are 270 electoral votes on the table as far as that goes, it still doesn't prevent the Republicans from seizing more state legislatures. So it just still has to remain a huge priority, irrespective of what happens with the EC moving forward into future elections. Yeah, yeah.
By the way, but that could certainly give the broader ecosystem a lot more motivation to care about state houses than they have, in the last several decades.
Right.
That and you know, Dobbs should do the same thing. I mean, my entire theme is, guys, the sword of the entire right wing attack are the state houses. That Mississippi law that Dobbs upheld didn't just show up in the Supreme Court. It was passed in a rigged state house. So were the other ones. Until we go back to those places and engage there, they will continue to not only be, I just go back to soccer, shooting at our goal again and again, but the shots are going to go through.
Yeah.
And so any way that we can get people to see that a responsible pro-democracy battle plan, of course, includes winning federal races, but also includes significant infrastructure in states, including red states. Until we see that, I worry that most of the things that are outraging us every single day all around this country, until we broaden that battle plan, even winning the plan we currently have, which is mainly federal swing offices, doesn't change any of those attacks on democracy.
Is there some wisdom, and I swear to God, we'll wrap up here in a second, David, is there some wisdom to shutting the F up about certain things, at least in terms of a large public footprint of issue X or issue Y? Is there wisdom in keeping quiet about certain things? Because obviously, anytime Democrats speak up about a certain issue, the Republicans grapple onto that, politicize it, and then it gets destroyed. I always think of the climate crisis, for example. Like after An Inconvenient Truth came out, there was huge popular numbers in support of ameliorating the climate crisis. Or after Michael Moore's Sicko movie came out, huge popular support for healthcare reform. And then as soon as it becomes a political football, it becomes politicized and the Republicans start to sink their teeth into it messaging wise. And it kind of becomes a thing and popular support dies as a result of that. So is there wisdom in maybe not making such a big deal out of certain things and kind of doing a quiet push behind the scenes under the radar, something like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are different ways to think about it. I mean, it's sort of what I was saying about the Electoral College one.
Yeah.
I think you need to know what are the issues that are really resonating. Mm-hmm. What are the issues that get your own turnout fired up to show up? And I have a whole chapter on this. What are the ways that you can make sure people see the how extreme the other side is? And that's really important. Sometimes I think we actually make a mistake. And so sometimes, yeah, they may bring up something and you may think, you know what, that's just to get me off a topic that I'm going to win on.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to spend the next 2 months talking about the topic they're bringing up. I'm going about the fact that, you know, as Gretchen Whitmer ran on, you got to fix the damn roads. And she won because she stuck to that. Or Laura Kelly in Kansas focused on the fact that all those tax cuts had destroyed those schools in Kansas. And she's governor twice now because of that. So you don't always want to get baited by everything they bring up. But yeah. At the same time, what I would say is sometimes, and actually most of the time, the issues they are really ginning up, often they are actually pushing an issue where they are on the wrong side of that issue. And so last year, out of the blue, sort of, the Dobbs decision came down. And there was some talk in the country to Democrats sort of shaming them. Oh, you're talking about it too much. Get back to the real issues. No, that was the winning issue everywhere because it was this dramatic sort of encapsulation of what a tax on freedom meant to everyday people, obviously women. And so sometimes if they are exposing how extreme they are, don't just switch back to whatever you were thinking was your great issue. And Gretchen Whitmer and John Fetterman were great examples of this. Actually take the issue that they've been fighting for and draw it to its most logical but accurate extremes. And there's no better example of how that worked than Fetterman, as much as he was recovering from a stroke, for goodness sakes, did a debate where he walked, Oz down the pike of saying abortion should be decided between a woman, her doctor, and the local public official. That was the end of the campaign. Yeah. And so the point is, don't assume that when they're on an issue and getting freaked out about it, it's on Fox News, that they're somehow in the majority. Book banning is deeply unpopular. We've seen school board candidates all around the country, including Ohio, lose because they were viewed as right-wing book banners. So many of the topics they are running with right now are actually themselves unpopular. And don't miss the opportunity at times to point out just how extreme they are. And if everyone had followed the advice of some, which is, oh, you're talking about abortion too much. If Dobbs It was McConnell and candidates like Mike DeWine, Ohio. They wanted Dobbs to no longer be discussed. They told Lindsey Graham, don't bring up a national abortion ban. And if every Democrat had listened to the advice, oh, well, it's time to move on, you're sounding too much on culture issues, we actually would not have done as well as having that issue be front and center all the way through November. So yeah. I think you got to be smart about when you decide to walk away and not. And the other one is, I put this in the book, when they are really using dog whistle racism, which sadly is a tactic of theirs right now. And again, people might have different opinions on this. I think when Democrats sort of walk away and pretend it's not happening, it's a mistake, because it's going to be in the ether. And if you don't say anything about it, it will dominate. And I think you're better off confronting and saying, and this is some really good thinkers. I quoted my book about this. A woman named Anna Shankar Rosario has come up with a whole way you approach that. You need to call it out as a divisive tactic that's being used by them to accomplish some goal that we all oppose, because that's what it is. And so I think there are a lot of every campaign's gonna be faced with these moments. But sometimes I think you don't respond when you're baited. Other times they may have given you a gift like abortion extremism. And other times you're better off trying to contextualize their attack and bring it back to your issue, as opposed to simply ignoring it. And all of a sudden they've won because their dog whistle was effective. So I think it's, you know, there's some really important decisions at key points, but there are different options depending on the circumstances.
So the book is Saving Democracy. It's a companion to your amazing previous work, Laboratories of Democracy. It's available everywhere you get your digital books. There's a Kindle version on Amazon, for example. I'll put a link in the description under this episode at bobsesca.com. David, thank you so much for joining me today. Where can people find you on the socials?
So first of all, thank you for having me. It's a real treat to talk with you again and to walk through this new book, which I'm excited to start getting. When you write a book, you start to get, like, right now it just hit people's mailboxes. People are starting to read it. So it's really exciting to have people start getting feedback. Thank you for letting me do that. I'm at Twitter at David Pepper, which is where I put most of my whiteboards.
Yep.
I also am on Substack. Basically, look up David Pepper on Substack. I've got a newsletter with all these topics, a little longer than tweets, obviously. And I'm also, you know, I've started something on Spoutable and others, just depending on if Twitter explodes or implodes. And I have a YouTube thing too, David Pepper for Ohio. But the main place you'll hear from me is the Twitter, David Pepper, and David Pepper on Substack.
Are you on TikTok yet? Is that something you've done?
You know what? I am on TikTok, and I guess I'm just getting too old. I'm a guy who, my whiteboard videos on Twitter really do well.
Yeah.
And my TikTok videos, no one seems to care. It's the same video. So
yeah.
I haven't figured out how to turn TikTok into something big. But if you like TikTok, I'm at David Pepper OH on TikTok. So help me figure out how to get it done there, because I'm clearly not very good at it.
Yeah, well, if you can figure it out, let me know, because I'm trying to figure it out myself too. I don't know. I don't know what it takes.
I mean, maybe there's just an, I don't know your age, but maybe I'm just at an age where I'm just cut off from being a TikTok influencer, but
well,
I'm giving it my best. I'll say that.
Yeah, I'm 51, so I think we're generally
the same exact age. That's the problem. We are. Right. There must be an expiration date of like around 40 years old to be relevant on TikTok.
Yeah, I did a video yesterday, David, where I included a shot of Donald Trump doing that two-fisted dance that he does that looks kind of sexually suggestive. I'll just put it that way. And I put it in my video. And the video actually got flagged for being sexually explicit. And so they took it down, and I had to tell them, well, no, that's just the ex-president and how he dances.
Right.
I couldn't believe it.
Now, there may be videos of him that should be banned back in Russia, but that's not the one.
All right, David, take care. We'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Tooth bar at midnight. Susan's my right hand. I'm all the water in Mexico, and she is the sand. And I didn't mean to hurt you, but I gotta be what I am. The truth is there's just not enough time in the history of man. So bring out your priest, bring out your book, put me down on my knees. Take me down to the river and drop me in the water if you think it might help me, please. But there's no way that God can save me, no, there's nothing that God will do. There's There's no way that God will save me now. There's nothing that God will do for me now. First one comes out hungry, the second one eats the day, the third one feels nobody loves him, and the fourth one finds a way. And to my sons, I'm sorry, come see me when you're grown. Pull on my beard and punch me in the belly and tell me how much you own. And bring out your priest, bring out your book, put me down on my knees. Take me down to the river and drown me in the water if you think you might find some peace. But there's no way that God will save you now. There's nothing that God will do. There's no way that God will save you now. There's nothing that God will do for you now. I was once 13, I was once 21, and once I had a dream. All the people that I know look like animals to me. Some are sheep and some are wolves and some are hardly free. Bring out your priest, bring out your book, put me up on your knee. Down to the river, float me in the water if you think you might help me see. But there's no way that God will save us now. There's nothing that God will do. There's no way that God will save us now. There's nothing that God will do for us now. There's nothing that God will do for us now. There's nothing that God will do for us now.